do these things. We love to have that fun. We love to do these things on WEFT. Who knows, this could be the new jingle for WEFT.
I repeat that.
Who knows, this could be new jingle for WEFT.
Freestyle.
Like, we prepared for it, yeah.
And to check out what's happening in community radio, go to weft.org, where you can donate now, you can listen live, you can listen on demand to our two-week music archive, courtesy of spinatron.com, and you can also check out the public affairs archives, and so much more that you can do at weft.org.
This hour of programming is supported by the listeners of WEFT and by the Champaign Center Partnership, who foster a vibrant, inviting, and active core downtown, midtown, and campus town by strengthening businesses and building community. The CCP vision is to create healthy and vibrant micro-urban areas for residents and visitors through marketing, advocacy, and special events. CCP encourages and educates the public to shop locally throughout the year. Local businesses need your help more than ever. When you spend $100 at a locally owned business, $68 stays in your community. For more information about the Champaign Center Partnership, visit them on their website at champaigncenter.com or feel free to call 217-352-2400. We're trying to do what we can to automate programming here at WEFT as much as possible. We have had a few air shifters come into the station this week that have had no contact with the air shifter before them or the air shifter after them. We're all working diligently to keep the booth and the surroundings as clean and disinfected as possible. And we do appreciate the fact that you are continuing to listen, and we appreciate the fact, we hope that you appreciate the fact that we are doing all we can to keep our air shifters safe and to automate our programming as much as possible during these times.
This is Dave Monk, the Prairie Monk, WEFT Champaign 90.1 on your FM dial. We've been experimenting. Last week we put in pictures of Busey Woods, and I listened to it. I think it worked. We're getting to be a bit more technological with this Zoom thing. And I think the presence of pictures are important. Today I want to talk about sculpturing, and especially this vernacular sculpting. Last night, my sister in Australia sent me five pictures of her garden. And really, it is a sculpted piece. She has plum trees here and annuals there. And you can even see the weed patch that have onions that are annoying because they got in some soil that was weedy. And it reminded me that we're looking at natural areas, and natural areas are often a sculpted feature in themselves. If you're wanting to study the geology, often you can see the geology by the plants that are growing on certain rocks. And you can, if it's sedimentary rock and it's running right along a hill, you can see the nature of the geology. In a simple fashion, you can look at a pond and you can see how the plants sort themselves out according to very wet and more less wet and dry. So humans are fairly oriented to this sort of thing too. So locally, we look at the end of our street. There is an upturned jester that is part of a light fixture. And it's the sort of thing that makes people stop and look and think. And across the road, this is still on Market Street, a stone's throw from left, there are a set of tumbling boxes that are sort of welded together, but you have to think about those boxes and how they would fall. And we have in our storefront a glyph that is a secret society glyph. It has a tent with the door open, so you're welcome in. There's the eye of God looking over. There's faggots, which are a collection of ideas, or sometimes they're used to put on somebody's door if they have been misbehaving with their family or with alcohol or something like that. Then a faggot might appear on the door. And that glyph came from about 200 yards away on the Oddfellows building, which was pulled down when the Busey Bank expanded. That set of shops that were on the corner opposite the city building were taken down. The Oddfellows had a structure. Often the structure had a religious base, but it was basically an insurance company that meant that in the days when your farmer may be kicked in the stomach with a horse and not survive, then the family would be looked after. So these secret societies were not only a place of camaraderie, but they were also a place where people would look after friends and relatives if there was a necessity. They were secret societies. There were a number of them. Some were named the Indians, or some were named variously, and many of them still exist as insurance companies. Modern Woodsman still exists as an insurance company. But there's a lot of paraphernalia that goes with the odd pillows, flags, and there's usually a coffin with a simulated body in it, a skeleton, and this is designed to frighten initiates, to make them respect the crowd, and there's a lot of ritual that goes with that. The Oddfellows building around the corner on Neal Street was a three-story building. The male contingent was on the upper floor. It was like a ballroom, but it was designed to introduce invited guests who might become members. A very male floor. The second floor was the Rebecca's, that were a support group, but they had their rituals too. On the ground floor, there was usually commercial access to the street, and that was a building that was used by the shopkeeper that was there, probably an associate. These buildings were architecturally interesting, some of them more than others. A lot of the structure depended on the leadership. I hung around for quite some time because there was a glyph on the front. Although secret, the society was announced as the Oddfellows Building and United Order of Oddfellows. But there was a glyph that was there, and I kept uncovering it when it was covered with rubble, and eventually got seven people. It was a cast, and we brought that around to Market Street, and it's still in the front door. It was, to some extent, a part of the structure of the building. And so that glyph was to give you an idea of the Oddfellows and announce to the public that this was a place of respect. I have been walking around the detention pond on 2nd Street with a view of thinking to do something for Earth Day on the 22nd of April. And I was interested in historical monuments. There is at the south end a bridge that used to be part of the interurban that ran from downtown Champaign, or the railroad line, to Urbana. And so that bridge is an engineering structure, but it's also an icon that has been left there and repaired. To the north, where a little pocket prairie is surviving, we had a fairly substantial lead plant there, which took about the best part of a day to dig out. It was probably 5 feet tall, 6 feet tall, and had roots in the pocket prairie on Market Street that reached out 6 and 8 feet. Very carefully, volunteers extricated those roots, and we took as much soil as we could to the detention pond and planted it there. It didn't have the subtle roots, the very small roots, and it was very damp, and the plant didn't survive. But for a while, it was a vernacular piece of art where birds would sit and enjoy. It has now fallen down. I was looking at that site and I think it needs some character. That is, it's in a cultural domain. It's a detention pond, so there are people there. I was thinking back to a egg-shaped piece of wood that I hauled out of a lagoon in the Peoria area. It was bobbing around, probably about 80% under the water. It was very heavy to move out. I eventually put it on a pickup truck, and over the years it dried out and it became a rather interesting egg-shaped body. And it has been to weddings, it has been to numerous events, and always it inspires some curiosity and some thought process. And I thought that might be the sort of vernacular art that might just go into the Pocket Prairie and be something that would remind people that there were human elements here. The egg-shaped piece of wood is about 3 feet long and probably not quite that much, 2 feet, and round, probably 2 feet across, and very well worn into an egg shape. You have to know that it was probably the upper portion of a pylon when on the Illinois River, which runs through Peoria, was remodeled. People were putting in pylons and they would put them into a depth where they felt like they were responsible. And then they would stop, and then they would saw off the tops to an equal level so they could put a crown on the pylons or build on them. So this piece of wood had been rolling around in the Illinois River and in the swampland behind for many years, and all the corners had been worn off. And I'm thinking that that might be a good place for that item to inspire some interest. Partially I've been inspired by the fact that on Scott Park there is a deer that has been allowed to be there. We have to be careful. We can't have sculpted pieces that would hurt anyone. So you have to be cautious. But sometimes there's a mobile sculpted piece. It's a dog. It gets brought because the intent is to frighten the geese. So somebody moves it around and puts it in different places. And the geese have been actually more mild-mannered in Champagne than in Abana. But they're a challenge because they graze the lawns and use the pond for looking for worms and the like, and they poop everywhere. So a banner has actually cleaned up its the area that approaches the Crystal Lake. All the edges have been made more park-like, so that the geese don't have breeding sites. Champagne has that problem too, and probably they reduce the numbers every so often. Sometimes it's sad because you see a lone goose. I went walking last night and there was a lone goose sitting in a sort of hidden place, and I almost stepped on it, and it got up and then parked itself in the middle of the parking lot and sat down ready for a night's sleep. And I had to wonder if it had lost its mate. These geese marry for life. And sometimes it's sad when they lose a partner. I go to Lake Park, and Lake Park is interesting. It was taken off Route 45 when it was widened. So it's partially remnant plants plus reconstruction prairie with a huge meander, which was cut off, and the meander has become Lake Park. And one of the retirees, Richard Engelbrick and his wife, Wiggins, have had a lot to do with preserving a 30-year-old prairie where those plants were planted with the support of Dick Burwash, who owned the land. First, we rented a little piece. There's the cutoff is a fast-flowing cutoff, and it has groins or little places where there are waterfalls to stop the speed. If you're going to have a big meander, it's going to take time to move around the meander. If you cut off the neck, then the velocity of the water is great and it can cause erosion. The Lake Park people have preserved, bought that 2.5 acres. And Richard Engelbrecht has been doing metal sculpting, and he's been putting sculptured pieces on the prairie. And the Lake Park itself has a prairie, and there are sculpted pieces there too. You don't know where the inspiration comes from. It may come from the ships that somebody came from when they came from Europe. It may come from friends. It may actually be an anathema to friends because they can't understand how you'd want to create a vernacular piece of art which is often degraded in commentary as folk art or found art or not very complimentary, because most of the artists are not trained artists. They're self-taught, or they may have gone to a grotto or some feature that has given them an idea, and they in turn give other people ideas. It may be just taking three cars and turning them up at a 45-degree angle and burying the front of the car in the ground and just making a statement. But often one idea leads to another, and there seems to be more grottos and stations of the cross and elements of sculptural work that went along with early settlement. It's not so much a common feature of today, although I'm talking about my sister's garden, the Oddfellows cliff, and the sculpted piece at the end of Market Street. We're very lucky that we have those situations to be able to talk about them and introduce them to others. They're often rather vulnerable because as you go into a different era, the children and grandchildren don't always want to take over this interest, and the cultural piece gets to be broken down and not maintained very well, and theft can occur. There's a very nice retreat in Wisconsin where the public, the church people, would bring pieces of rock, crystals, or interesting objects to include in a grotto. And those crystals and pieces are actually rather valuable, and they can attract thieves who want to make money from them. My sister is sad because she had a bird bath near to the street, and the bird bath has disappeared. And this is not something that's peculiar to America. It is peculiar to humans. They do this sort of thing everywhere. The Australian Aboriginals have rituals. Often it involves the removal of a tooth and the challenge of perhaps circumcision. And that goes with ritual dancing and corroborees and hidden places where tarungas or rare elements are hidden. It goes back to the Huns and the Picts that would invade Europe, the Danes and the Scandinavians that would invade England, Alfred the Great, who preserved some of the Celtic background. Always there's some symbology that goes with the religion or the event or the personalities. Sometimes the personalities are important because they are often wealthy leaders or have been, and they can inspire artists to do interesting things. So you get Michelangelo or other artists that do that sort of thing with the support of wealthy leaders. We when I realized that there was very little prairie left, and often I felt that people didn't understand their own landscape. Midwest landscape was regarded as flat and perhaps uninteresting compared with the East or the West or the Rocky Mountains. And but there is subtlety in the landscape. And so we created a Heartland. It was a reading the landscape course at Parkland College. And I would take people to some of these sites that included grottos or works of art or landscapes that were different. Sometimes it was gardens. I can remember going to Watseka in Iroquois County, where there was a grotto, a set of electric light bulbs on poles in a circumventure and on the banks of the Iroquois River. And the gentleman that owned the site would baptize people in the river. Another person some distance away from that site had a house with a full-scale railroad around it with a caboose, and that was his monument. And it's often a family monument. Sometimes it's women that get involved. They are women with tremendous energy. They meet the dictates of being a wife in an era when women didn't get to vote, and they were in effect sculpted as women. So she could knit and do all sorts of womanly things, including have six children. But then she started to get interested in grottos, and nobody knows where that came from. It might have been the augmentation of a fireplace, and that extended to wings on the fireplace. Each time she would take a look, she would expand or feel a need for something else. And she had six children, so she had a workforce. And then she took in animals and a zoo, and she tended these animals very well. And people would come and enjoy and be inspired by this sort of activity. And so women do get into the act of creating often several images, or even a whole farm of images. There's one site where the farmer more or less retired and didn't do dairying anymore. He was on a rolling hill, and he created X number of sculpted pieces. Some of these people have discovered cement, and they often use glass pieces because they reflect and have different colors, and they can make different statements. And he would augment the house. He would make a statement about politics. An elephant and a donkey pulling the same cart, and you have to wonder who's doing what and how. a statement was made many years ago, but is genuine right now. The wife in that case was very supportive. She roamed the territory after she'd had her family and was a salesperson for farm equipment. So often the wives were supportive and instrumental in contributing to the cause, and probably not looking like doing so, but very supportive, a little bit like Lady Bird Johnson was a supporter for President Johnson in his day, but silent, visible, but silent. That has changed a lot. Women have had come a long way in 200 years. They got the vote in 1923, but it was mainly for white people. Now we have to think about how the lower income people express themselves. What is a Mexican hat to you? What is a group of honey tots dancing in the street very cleverly? What is a yard of secondhand materials, some of which have obligations as making a statement? I can remember going to one place in Wisconsin where there was this huge pipe. There was a tractor seat at the bottom, and you could stargaze in your imagination with this piece of equipment that was substantial. You had to have a crane to put it up. Right nearby, there was a 5/8 inch piece of steel with a crack in it, and that represented the action of lightning. And so sometimes there's a spirituality, sometimes it's a religious background, sometimes it's just plain inspiration. The farmer who retires and his son runs the farm, and he's sort of been very busy all his life, and now he's not. So he looks around, and that lawn looks bare. Now let's put up a something. So he puts up a fence that is made partially out of old sulky wheels to give the curves. And then inside he puts a tower or some other statement. And these are the sorts of items that a car that's moving at 50 miles an hour will suddenly put on its brakes and come back to have a look. What the hell was that? There was a Fred Smith in Wisconsin who was a lumberjack. He never learned to read and write, but he was a rather clever gentleman. He had worked with animals. He knew deer and horses and oxen, and he had a little tavern. And in retirement, he started to create 100 pieces. And those 100 pieces are almost comic in their cartoonery, their simplicity. Sometimes it's just a rock that has the shape that is the shape that it was intended. And once again, concrete was very, very helpful. The principle in that case was that Fred Smith felt that the Indian population was getting a raw deal. So when he wanted to depict a signing or an acceptance of a agreement, then he would make the Indian recipient twice as high as the Caucasian who was providing the treaty, which everyone sort of knew that would not be adhered to. Sometimes it was clever, but the artist didn't have training in having sculpted an armature inside the horse. If you're going to have a horse standing on one foot, you need to have a structure within the sculpted piece that will preserve it, because these sculpted pieces are very vulnerable to rain, storms, and theft. Sometimes people do pick up whole sculpted pieces. Just luckily around the corner, we had a sculpted piece that ended up in the junkyard. Fortunately, the junkyard people felt that this was something more than junk. But it would suggest that sometimes it requires a little bit of intelligence to be able to read into the sculpture what the artist was intending. But then if he's very clever, he will leave it up to you to decide what you think was intended. And he may not even deign to tell you what his intent was. And you go away and you have to think about that. So there are people who know about these places. They often are told about them, people who write in kindness. And so there are specialists in preserving these sites. In the case of Fred Smith, a tornado went through and there were a bunch of School of the Art Institute people who have repaired the sculpted pieces as best they can, and the site is open to the general public. The family was not awfully impressed by Fred Smith doing this, but it was there. The sculpted piece might be also a very academic piece. Frank Lloyd Wright had his own style of building. He had farmland, and he related his prairie buildings, low and flat, and with the extended eyebrows, so that you could be inside with the windows open, you could see out. But people on the outside would have a hard time seeing in. You didn't have to put up curtains. Those buildings became remarkable pieces, as do high-rise buildings in New York or other places. But some of them have a very specific character. Some of the buildings in Chicago have pieces of that have been stolen from other regions in the world and incorporated in the buildings. And some of those pieces are now being returned to the places where they were taken from. And there's always a lot of debate about who owns what and who pays for what. But basically, those pieces were stolen as interesting artifacts. I'm trying to think. I'm thinking of other art situations where there are grottos that have Stations of the Cross that are fairly formal, and they have meaning, and they become a teaching site for others who get inspired. We have a situation in Kewanee, Illinois, where a mathematician had a family farm. His thesis was a four-line thesis. He became a watch maker, in a sense, because he created a formula that helped to strengthen the springs of a watch for the Elgin Watch Company. And one of his clocks has been in the Union. It is in storage now, but it was on top of the Union. And so this person got a degree in mathematics, returned home, and he would wander around in a cloak or less than that, and was regarded as kind of eccentric. But he built a house with bricks that he brought from Kewanee, about 2 or 3 miles, on his bicycle. And his building has character in that it had a little turret which had an Eastern character. His dining space was in the basement, that you could see it through an open window on the second floor. His wife was not a vegetarian, whereas this gentleman was. So they had separate tables. And he built a solarium because she got what was probably TB, tuberculosis in its day. And he would double her around on his bicycle. She passed as her daughter had passed. He knew the daughter first, and she passed, and he married her mother. So there are stories that go with these sculpted pieces. Some people think that territory is kind of weird, but this is a gentleman who had lots of intelligence. So he would make gutters out of wood that were quite effective. He had an air conditioning plant, which was basically a tunnel through the cold ground, and on the end a windmill that would suck cool air into the house. He made himself a coffin out of steel that he could be cremated on a pyre outside the building. Another sculpted piece. He created a gun, and with the intent of committing suicide because he had a very painful hernia or something like that. And he asked the city that, or requested in his will, that he be cremated on that mound. The city didn't do that, but the mound is still there, and that's a story and a sculpted piece. The English sometimes are very good at doing this. At one stage, we're around the world with land here and there, so they sometimes have left their mark, importantly, on pubs that people are a very friendly place in a village. And you have that here. You have an Englishman in charge of the Blind Pig, and some of the artifacts he uses are, I'm sure, related back to the pubs he knew in England as Chris Knight. So I encourage you, as you put in your pollinator garden, think about sculpting it. Think about putting in an artifact. Think about giving it a story. And it takes some talent, because the plants you use will sometimes get to be overburdening, so you have to control them. Some plants will crawl. Some plants, like roses, will have underground rhizomes, and you have to get to know them. I have a dentist who had a spare plot next door, and so we created a 10 by 10 raised garden bed, and we put about 30 species, prairie species, into it. And for a long time, those species did battle with each other, and they extended out into the garden that surrounded. Some creatures like sunflowers can grow 18 feet tall and fall over, and they walk. So if it falls down, then it makes a growth of sunflowers there. Then if they walk, they can move around, they can become very dominant. And a little clover sitting in the bottom might not have the same chance. So you have to provide light, and you have to put the plants in some sort of respect. And there could be a glacial erratic, because that's created the soil that is so rich. The little plot no longer exists because the dentist retired. He's now 95. And the plot was sold, and it's been, there's a garage right on the spot. So you have to be a little sad, because sometimes you lose your sculpted piece. It might be a ship that's in the sea, but sometimes it is also a sculpted piece for underground divers. Just as you have reefs and mudflats and islands, and they all can be part of the wonder of your life and how you lived and how you live with other creatures. We're losing creatures at such a rapid pace that you can't believe, before we've even got to know how they work, how they digest food, how they travel countless thousands of miles, how they eat food. And we have to think about how we arrange for chemicals that can take out prairies, they can take out trees, but they can also take out the living creatures that we care for. And so as you build your pollinator, think about letting it be a statement. In some streets, like prairie streets, the native vegetation and the gardens have crept out into the public space between the road and the walkway is public space. And I give the city credit because they could come along and exterminate the plants that are in that space. But as long as there's a relationship to the house, which may also make a statement, or to the people that they know, or to the whole street that gets to do the same thing, it's contagious. And it gets represented in city meetings occasionally. So there are variances. So if you have a little prairie and you're frightened it's going to be mown at the wrong time of the year, then set up a variance and let the city know what you're doing. It's nearly time for us. So think about your vernacular art and your one little piece that I am thinking of, I took to the forest preserve, was a wind vane. But it, when the wind blew, the arms and the legs moved. And that, I thought, was a vernacular art. And you might find the same sort of thing. So don't throw it out, but find it a place. This is Dave Monk, Prairie Monk, WEFT, Champaign 90.1 on your FM dial.
Listening to the radio station where the mighty host of heaven sing.
Turn your radio on.
Turn your radio on.
Turn your radio on.
Turn your radio on.
If you want to hear the songs of Zion coming from the land of the endless spring.
Hi, this is Jeff Tweedy from Wilco, and you're listening to 90.1 FM Champaign, WEFT.
The WEFT Music Archives are back. You can listen on demand thanks to our partners at Spinatron. Many of our music shows are once again available archived on our website. Go to our Spinatron calendar page at weft.org and click on any of the green colored shows. You'll be able to start an in-browser player and listen to that show whenever you want. Look for the in-browser player, click on the little triangle to start playback. Now, because of copyright restrictions, the music shows can only remain online for 2 weeks. So if you caught part of a show and you want to hear it all, get back to WEFT within 2 weeks after the show first aired, and you can check out our amazing locally produced, homegrown grassroots music on your schedule. Conveniently, whenever you need to, weft.org, just click on the Spinatron calendar page. I think that is labeled recent spins on the WEFT home page.
Programming at WEFT is brought to you in part by Minuteman Press. For a few special invitations printed or thousands of full-color flyers, Minuteman Press can help get it done on time and in budget. They offer an extensive line of products as well as design services. Due to COVID-19, please contact Minuteman Press for safe ordering, pickup, and delivery options. Phone 217-355-9222.